That's Tom Burris, who runs the seed company along with his brother. A bit of the backstory here. When Tom Burris's grandfather helped start the business back in 1935, it was part of a growing trend of commercial traders selling seeds. But the industry dynamics changed in the 1990s when science and business took hold in a new way. Companies like Monsanto and DuPont developed seed corn that embodied resistance to disease and pest. To gain market share, those firms started buying up seed companies, large and small, eventually acquiring industry giants like Pioneer Hybrid and DeKalb. Now, Monsanto, which hardly had a presence as a seed company back in 1990, is the nation's largest seed producer. Still, smaller companies like Burris serve an important role, says Chris Shaw, a New York equity analyst.
A big company like Monsanto clearly has to breed for, the entire country, but I think it's the independent guy that's really going to have a sort of a advantage at really tailoring their product to really sort of specific geographic areas. They don't try to be anything beyond that, and I think the local customer appreciates that as well.
Just over an hour north of St. Louis on a farm near Interstate 55, Wayne Ladage backs the John Deere tractor and seed planter out of his shed. Ladage farms about 1,000 acres. For his corn, he's always planted Burris, and he's also a dealer selling it to other area farmers. Ladage says he buys from Burris primarily to support another family-owned business.
And sometimes that might mean coming out in the middle of the night because we're running behind, say, planting corn in May or close to June, and because they're farmers too, they understand what we're going through, and that's a closeness that we share that's important to me.
For Tom Burris, that family feel is part of his sales pitch.
So we publish our home phone numbers, our cell phone numbers, and if a customer ever feels like he didn't get what he was entitled to, we invite him to call us. I don't think you can call Mr. Monsanto. I don't think you can call Mr. Pioneer.
Another selling point is that Burris can license the use of certain genetic traits from the big companies, and they mix and match those into their own recipe of sorts. The big players also have reasons not to run out all the small independent seed companies, says Greg Ruley, CEO of the Independent Professional Seed Association, a Nebraska-based trade group.
I think most of those companies, the larger multinationals, have realized that they've probably reached a point of saturation in terms of how much market they can control without finding themselves sideways of an antitrust law or other protections that might be in place.
Burris has its own growth plan. The company is partnering with other independent seed companies in areas ranging from training to growing. And this year, Burris will unveil software for planting equipment that can put different amounts of seed on different parts of a field depending on the soil type. Plus,
now we've taken in our fourth generation, which is my niece and nephew and my son-in-law, and they are owners with us.
He holds out hope for a fifth generation as well. He's already had his grandson out in the field detasseling corn in the summer. Bill Wheelhouse, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public radio stations in the Midwest covering farming and food. More information is available at harvestpublicmedia.org. It's 12:44. You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jeff Bossert. The new movie 42 portrays the struggle of Jackie Robinson as Major League Baseball's first African-American player broke through with the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. All current players are honoring his memory today by wearing that number on their uniform. A University of Illinois history professor who serves on the Sports Origins Committee says the film doesn't pull any punches when it comes to the blatant racism of that era. I spoke with Adrian Burgos on where the film both achieves and falters.
The filter was not taken off. We really hear what Jackie Robinson heard, which was a repugnant manager of the Phillies using every racial epithet that he could throw at Jackie and was doing so unrepentantly. And then they also get to see the backstory to a famous photo that the National League president had arranged where Ben Chapman and Jackie Robinson were staged as having reconciled their differences. And this is what went over the air to in the newspapers throughout the country, and Americans got to see that, but they didn't really see a lot of the backstory. It was put out for public consumption that baseball is okay with integration, but it wasn't. There was still a lot of resistance. And so 42 does a good job of showing that there was a lot of hostility throughout the 1947 season, even as people kept warming up to this idea of integration.
So, and as someone who is involved in historical, accurate baseball, part of an origins committee, I mean, you're happy with the result.
Well, I'm happy with how they captured the power of the resistance to integration. And they do get a very good job with the filming and the emotion. And the other thing that they really did, which we don't get to see in most depictions of this, is the intense relationship and how alone Jackie was in having to rely on Rachel Robinson. For Rachel Robinson, it was Jack. It wasn't Jackie, it was Jack. And home was a refuge. And she also came to the ballpark to be his support. You really see what sustained them through the year was each other. Now, there are a few Hollywood moments created for effect, and many of those were actually portrayed by one of my favorite actors in Harrison Ford, who does a wonderful job of presenting us a Branch Rickey. And it's the Hollywood Branch Rickey, because we don't see the Branch Rickey who besmirched the Negro Leagues and literally attempted to steal black talent from the Negro Leagues. We see a Branch Rickey who is a moral crusader and believes that integration should happen because it's the right thing. Branch Rickey, at best, was an imperfect ally to civil rights. He pursued integration to bring in black players and to improve his Brooklyn Dodgers. That was always part of Branch Rickey's DNA as a baseball genius, really. He created the St. Louis Cardinals with their farm system, and he succeeded in every place he went until he got to Pittsburgh.
The part that I did not know anything about was that Rickey originally wanted to have three black players introduced in the big leagues.
And the amazing part of that story is historian John Thorne, which you had recently on the program, and Jules Tigeel discovered it in Branch Rickey's papers at the Library of Congress, that Branch Rickey had originally attempted to sign three players, Robinson, Roy Campanella, and Sam Jethro. And what sidetracked that plan was that two of the Negro League team owners, Effa Manley with the Newark Eagles, and the owner of the Cleveland Buckeyes, where Sam Jethro played, they demanded compensation. That's when he changed the story. Literally, in the margins of this document was going to be an article published in Look magazine that it was Branch handwriting says, "Don't, that's not the story. I always intended to tell it to sign one," and edits out the original version of the plan. You know, one would wonder, how does the story change if it was three black men playing on the same team going through the struggle together?
I know players will have wearing the 42 number at Monday's games. Do you think people will develop a new appreciation or a better understanding of Jackie Robinson's story?
They will know the Hollywood Jackie Robinson story. What the movie does not fully flesh out is what goes on with Robinson after 1947. And in fact, we don't see the 1972 Jackie Robinson, who 10 days before he dies is at Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati. And his reasoning for being there was to keep the one fight that he saw that baseball had not succeeded at. He initially refused the invitation from Louis Kuhn, Commissioner of Baseball, to appear at the 1972 World Series to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the breaking of the color line. And he insisted that baseball had to hire a black manager. And on the stage, the national stage, for the last time, he went down swinging once again. He said, "I would be most proud when I could look down the third base line and see the face of a black manager there." And with those words, Jackie hit his last home run, took his swing, and it took 3 years for it to happen. He was already dead, but Frank Robinson was able to realize the dream that Jackie had for himself and for others. And that part of the baseball integration story is not told in 42, but it's an important part of even Jackie's own fight.
That's University of Illinois history professor Adrian Burgos, who serves on Major League Baseball's Origins Committee, with historian John Thorne, who was a recent guest on Focus. Burgos was also a consultant on Ken Burns' 2010 documentary, The 10th Inning. Burgos weighed in with his thoughts on the movie 42. It's Jackie Robinson Day in the major leagues, meaning all players today will wear the fame number on the uniforms. He broke baseball's color line 66 years ago today.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 15th of April, 2013. Today is tax day, the 15th day of April. The income tax in effect in this country since Congress ratified the 16th Amendment back in 1913, back when the income tax form was only 2 pages long. Dave Barry said, "It's income tax time again. Americans, time to gather up those receipts, get out those tax forms, sharpen up that pencil, and stab yourself in the aorta." It's the birthday of the humorist Morris Bishop, born in Willard, New York, in 1893. His father was a doctor, and he was born at the Willard State Hospital for the Insane, where his father worked and his grandfather had worked before him. Morris Bishop went off to Cornell, studied Romance languages, became a full-time professor there, stayed there for the rest of his career. A brilliant scholar, fluent in German, Swedish, Latin, modern Greek, French, Spanish, wrote biographies of Pascal, Champlain, La Rochefoucauld, Petrarch, and St. Francis. But we know him as the author of Light Verse, the man who wrote, "I lately lost a preposition, it hid, I thought, beneath my chair, and angrily I cried, perdition, up from out of in under there. Correctness is my vade mecum, and straggling phrases I abhor, and yet I wondered, what should he come up from out of in under for?" It's the birthday of Henry James, author of 20 novels, 112 stories, 12 plays, and several books of travel and criticism. Born in New York City, 1843. Father was a friend of Thoreau, Emerson, Hawthorne. Family traveled throughout Europe. When Henry James was in his 20s and writing short stories, he moved to Europe because he could live cheaply there, and he fell in love with England. He wrote, "The capital of the human race happens to be British." What he really wanted to be, though, was a dramatist. But one of his plays was poorly received, and James himself was booed on opening night, and that discouraged him. He never earned much money from his writing, nor did he win the acclaim that he had hoped for. His friend Edith Wharton lobbied for him to win the Nobel Prize, to no avail. And towards the end of his life, James got a generous advance from Scribner's for a new book, an advance that actually secretly came from Edith Wharton.